President Obama and John Kerry's politically diplomatic efforts in Cuba and Iran.
We're going to have to leave it there. Vina Trehan, Elif Elifson, and Annie Tuller Payne, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us. And a very happy birthday to Robbie Caron.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Health Club's Body Positive Block Party, Thursday, October 22nd at Health Club in Portland. The Body Positive Block Party is an inaugural bash for Portland's first body positive, worker-owned, community-centered barbell gym. Again, that's the Body Positive Block Party on Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at Health Club, 1235 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Jacko as part of the We Real Cool KBOO at the Clinton Jazz Film Series on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. Jacko tells the story of Jaco Pastorius, a self-taught, larger-than-life musician who changed the course of modern music. Never-before-seen archival footage unveils the story of Jaco's life, his music, his demise, and the lasting victory of artistic genius. Again, that's Jacko, Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today is the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality. It's also the first of 3 days of Rise Up October, which is being organized to draw attention to police abuse across the country.
The website WikiLeaks has released documents gleaned by hackers from the personal email of former CIA Director John Brennan.
And the town of Banks in Washington County here in Western Oregon is trying to retain the name The Braves for its local sports teams, despite a recent state law requiring all Native American mascots and names to be phased out.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Today is the first day of Rise Up October, a three-day action that participants are calling a, quote, national manifestation against police terror. It's an expansion of the 18-year-old October 22nd coalition, which has used this date in October as a national day of protest against police brutality ever since 1996. Events on these days have resulted in the arrest and penalizing of protesters nearly every year. This weekend's planned events will take place mostly in New York City, with other events in cities across the country. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Lou Downey, an organizer with the Ferguson, Missouri branch of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, for more on this.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the October 22nd movement is and what's happening nationally today?
The National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, the Criminalization of a Generation initiated that, as well as Rise Up October, by Dr. Cornel West and Carl Dix. And it was calling and bringing forward a national movement against what had become clear was a whole program across the country of police brutality and police murders. It was that became a time where demonstrations all over the country occurred to take that on, to expose it, but instead I'm saying it's got to stop. Rise Up October, that is the first day of Rise Up October. Tomorrow in New York City will be a shutdown starting at 9 a.m. at Rikers Island. Rikers Island, an island prison that sits only a few hundred yards from LaGuardia Airport and is in the sight of the glistening towers in Manhattan, but in fact has been a hellhole where many, many, many New Yorkers and some beyond have ended up in there, many spending long periods of time just awaiting, not convicted of anything, but being brutalized while awaiting their waiting, getting into court and paying bail.
And speaking of that, we're talking to you in Ferguson, Missouri, and Ferguson has been at or near the center of discussion and action about police brutality in recent years. And what is planned locally for today and this weekend?
Well, today there is a protest in downtown, which, like many others, is having the theme of reading people's names that have died at the hands of the police. People are leaving tomorrow to go to New York City to be there for the Rise Up October National March. Again, this is Rise Up October to Stop Police Terror. Which side are you on? And that is the theme of it. Because of what happened in Ferguson 14 months ago when youth took to the streets after Michael Brown had been killed by Darren Wilson and after his body had been left in the sun for 4 hours outside Canfield Apartments, people hit the streets and basically said, not this time. No, this has gone way too far. And they stood up in the police against what many of your listeners might have seen, armored vehicles, rubber bullets, massive tear gas, and refused to go back and back down in the face of the curfews and the National Guard in the state of emergency. And that sparked, the beginning of a nationwide movement against police murder. And it resonated so deeply just because many people around the country had felt what people here had, knew other examples of Mike Brown's. And that's part of why there is a real basis for Rise Up October this year, and a real need, because people have been in the streets now for 14 months, again and again, and there's been a very concerted effort to squash this movement, to discredit it. You hear stories of Black Lives Matter, the violent hate group, that kind of thing, to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of arrests, and many people, including here, still facing heavy charges over them for being in the streets protesting. And it's a crossroads. Is this movement going to bring many more people forward? People that have been awakened by the protests around the country but may have stayed on the sidelines, which side are you on? It's speaking to. No, now is the time. Everyone knows. You can't say you don't know. There is no neutrality, no middle ground in America. People have to come forward and join and go into the spread into the streets of New York. And in that way, the movement becoming much larger, more diverse and stronger, and making the question of stop of the epidemic of police murder something that is both seen around the world. That's why it's happening in the streets of Manhattan, including with 100 families of people that have died. Again, making it very, very clear that this is a state of emergency, but again, bringing many people from different walks of life. And there's been many people, including people who have signed on to this, well-known people that have, you know, voices of conscience that have said, we have to do this. We have to draw the line now.
What can people do across the country to get involved with this directly?
Well, go to StopMassIncarceration.net or RiseUpOctober.org, and you know, wherever possible, people should be in the streets of New York City. It's not too late to get there by October 24th for the National March. But there's other ways people can support it, including signing on and endorsing the national call. Donations have been very important because this is a tremendous project to bring the family members from around the country there in New York City. Again, before the eyes of the world, where it's impossible not to see both the pain and the horror in their lives, but also their courage and determination of standing up after facing all that and saying no.
All right. Lou Downey, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Sam Bowman, speaking with Lou Downey with the Ferguson, Missouri chapter of Stop Mass Incarceration.
The local group, Don't Shoot Portland, held a rally at Dawson Park this afternoon in solidarity with Rise Up October. Further information about local events this weekend can be found on the group's Facebook page.
President Barack Obama has been added to the list of speakers addressing those attending the 122nd International Association of the Chiefs of Police Annual Conference and Expo, which begins Saturday in Chicago, Illinois. Other federal officials participating in the four-day event include the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, as well as the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Defense. Commercial participants consist of more than 700 exhibitors and four different levels of sponsorships that range in price from $12,000 to $75,000 per company. Platinum-level sponsors include AT&T, Taser International, and Motorola Solutions, where former National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden now serves on the board of directors. Assistant Chief for the Portland Police Bureau, Kevin Modisa, is listed as a speaker for the Research and Programs track in a session entitled Arrest Less.
A controversial internet security and surveillance bill has passed a major hurdle in the Senate, although the bill has not yet passed. The so-called Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, or CISA, will provide incentives for companies to share user data with the federal government. Today, the Senate agreed to include a number of amendments, but did not agree to one proposed by Libertarian Senator Rand Paul, who claims that the bill would transform websites into government spy sites. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has vowed to continue the fight against the CISA bill, but says he would support it if certain amendments were included. While some groups purport that CISA is needed to stop hackers, some major tech firms like Apple, Google, and Dropbox have joined Senator Paul in calling the bill a major threat to internet freedom that will not even make the internet secure at all. Other major internet players like the Wikimedia Foundation and Yelp have also come out against the surveillance bill. A protest is being held by internet freedom advocates outside the United States Capitol this very evening.
As the International Association of Chiefs of Police gets ready for its conference in Chicago next week, an ugly facet of Chicago's police force continues to be uncovered by lawyers and investigative journalists with UK paper The Guardian. Honeman Square is a nondescript brick industrial building on Chicago's west side. According to The Guardian articles and a lawsuit filed on Monday by Chicago's People's Law Office, Honeman Square has been used as an off-the-books detention facility by the Chicago Police Department over the past 10 years. In that time, more than 7,000 arrestees were effectively, quote, disappeared, held behind bars or in chains without any public booking records or family notification, and questioned by police officers under conditions that, if true, would amount to gross human rights violations. Fewer than 1% of those arrested and taken to Holman were given access to attorneys, effectively leaving them to their own devices during the crucial early stages of interrogation. In most cases that have come to light, attorneys were not even notified of their clients' whereabouts. And this is not a facility that is necessarily set up to break hardened and violent criminals. Most of those arrested and charged, 74% or 54,000 people, were charged with drug possession. These numbers represent the tip of the iceberg as far as documentation goes. The Guardian and lawyers for former Holman Square detainees are continuing to pressure the Chicago police and government for more information. 65% of the documented Holman Square arrests occurred under the administration of the current mayor, Rahim Emanuel, who recently claimed that his police force operates entirely within the law. For its part, the police department has firmly denied any allegations of abuse or illegal detention at Holman Square. KBOO will continue to follow the story as it unfolds. Calls to the Chicago Police Department, Illinois' ACLU, the People's Law Office, and local police watchdogs were not returned in time for this broadcast.
Relief for prisoners and their families came from an unusual place today, the Federal Communications Commission. The commission approved a measure to cut add-on fees and cap rates on prisoner phone calls. Tanya Snyder has more on this from Washington, D.C.
Communication with friends and family on the outside is critical for prisoners' well-being, and it's shown to help reduce recidivism. But phone calls can be expensive. Two telecom companies, Securus and Global Tel Link, have a monopoly on prison phone calls. And their rates? Up to $14 a minute, according to the FCC. A lot of that money goes back to prisons and sheriff's departments in the form of massive kickbacks. So the prisons also have a stake in keeping prices sky high for the 2.2 million people behind bars in the United States. Securus even requires some of its prison clients to stop allowing in-person visits, making loved ones instead use a $1 a minute video visitation service. FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn has been a champion of this change, and at Thursday's hearing, she addressed 12-year-old Kevin Reese III, whose father is incarcerated.
The reason that we are doing this is because we care about your future. The reason we are here today is because you deserve relief. You deserve to be able to affordably keep in touch with your family. You deserve this. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for doing what so many millions of families deserve. Thank you very much.
The companies that have been making billions off these expensive phone calls are calling this a business-ending ruling. Millions of prisoners and their families may not mourn their loss. Tanya Snyder, FSRN in Washington.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee today approved a bipartisan sentencing reform measure. The Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, S-2123, passed on vote of 15-5. The bill contains sweeping changes to federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws. Civil rights organizations, including the NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, regard it as a good first step. They caution, however, that there is still a great deal of work left to do regarding criminal justice reform, sentencing, and prison reform at the federal level. The measure now goes to the full Senate for consideration. A similar, though broader, bipartisan measure was introduced in the House by that chamber's Judiciary Committee on October 8th. House Resolution 3713, the Sentencing Reform Act of 2015, is still in committee.
The state of Oregon filed suit today against General Nutrition Corporation, known as GNC, for selling supplements that contain banned ingredients. Attorney General Rosenblum's suit alleges that GNC stores sold products containing a drug called Picamelon. The chemical, which is a prescription drug manufactured and sold in Russia, is not approved for retail sale here in the United States. GNC is also alleged to have sold products containing beta-methylphenylamine, otherwise known as BMPEA, nice long word, which is an amphetamine-like chemical. The Attorney General said that there are 25 GNC stores here in Oregon that sold thousands of these products over the span of a couple of years. And the suit has been filed here in Multnomah County Circuit Court.
By the end of next year, all Oregon schools and teams with Native American mascots will need to change their names. In the town of Banks, however, residents are trying to preserve the Banks Middle School mascot, the Braves. A recent survey of 1,000 residents found 95% support keeping the name. The team logo is a silhouette of a Native American chief. But the fans do not have a tradition of mocking Native Americans with the so-called tomahawk gesture used by fans of the Atlanta Braves. In Banks, Oregon, the Parent Teacher Association and other supporters of the controversial mascot have printed up T-shirts that say, "Once a Brave, Always a Brave." Banks is a town of 1,900 people located north of Forest Grove in Washington County. The new superintendent is trying to build a relationship with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. If the school can get support of the tribe, they would be allowed to keep their mascot. Bearing that, some local residents have promoted the idea of dropping the S, changing the logo, and calling the team Banks Brave.
Health Republic Insurance, which is one of the consumer-operated and oriented plans created under the Affordable Care Act, announced recently that it will be shutting down. The announcement comes as a surprise to members who were told in late September by the company's CEO that Health Republic was strong and financially stable. Health Republic was one of two such co-op insurers here in the state of Oregon. The company insures about 15,000 people here in Oregon, including employees at more than 800 small businesses. Health Republic said that the federal government was not providing the company enough funding through its Risk Corridors program, so they couldn't afford to continue providing coverage. The company will honor its policies through the end of the year 2015 and stop operating on December 31st. 23 health insurance co-ops were originally created under the ACA, and only 15 of the original 23 remain in business. Oregon has been the only state with more than one plan. The state's other program, Oregon Health Co-op, is still in operation.
At the University of Oregon in Eugene, a new team uniform is also coming under fire for ignoring and even mocking Native Americans in the state. The football team is called the Pioneers, and the new uniforms feature a pictorial history of the state of Oregon. But the history fails to include many Native Americans. The front of the new uniform shows a handshake, which university officials say symbolizes the meeting of equals in a common goal and peace, friendship, prosperity, and trust. But Native advisors to the university, as well as Native students and alumni, point out that Native people were not equal participants in the settlement and colonization of Oregon. Tribes were made war upon, treaties were made, and tribes were removed to reservations to make way for settlers. This all came after tribes suffered from massive epidemics brought on by European colonizers, which caused the decline of populations at a rate of 97% for many tribes. David Lewis, an alumni of university and a member of the Grand Ronde tribe, has led the call for the University of Oregon to reconsider their new pioneer uniforms and develop a new design that respects the Native American communities in Oregon that were decimated by European colonization.
The KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll take a deeper look at the most recent violence in Israel and occupied Palestine. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. Tonight's show features a discussion on the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women exhibit that is currently on display at the Native American Student Center at Portland State University. Then at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 67 and a low of 47. Today in history, 6,019 years ago at 6 o'clock in the evening, the world was created. This is according to a fundamentalist reading of the Bible by 17th century Irish Archbishop James Usher. And in 1983, two prison officers were killed by inmates at the U.S. Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois, which precipitated the development of the Supermax model of prisons. Quote for today is from former Chicago mayor and boss of the Cook County Democratic Party, Richard Daley, who said, "Gentlemen, let's get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman is not there to create disorder. He is there to preserve disorder."
It's 5:24, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Who does David Keating think he's fooling? He heads an obscure corporate-funded group pushing to wipe out the few remaining limits on the special interests that put extremely big bucks into political campaigns. It's only fair to turn the fat cat donors loose, he explains, because an unlimited infusion of cash from, say, the Koch brothers would instantly make an unknown candidate competitive. After all, Keating adds, most startup operations need an angel investor, someone who believes in the project and puts money in to make it viable. Ah, yes, a devilish new twist on the old cash and carry business model. Our cash can carry you into office to help us. But a run for public office should not be thought of as a corporate startup and ought to be made viable not by the special interest money it attracts, but by the ability of its ideas and principles to draw public support. Also, while a corporate campaign donor clearly does see itself as an investor hoping to profit from the project, there's nothing angelic about it. Acknowledging that presidential, congressional, and many gubernatorial campaigns are now financed and even run by a small band of deep-pocketed elites, Keating says ordinary folks needn't worry, for this top-heavy system really doesn't mean that the officials it elects will put their patrons' interests over the public's. Really? Well, he admits, while those who paid for the election will naturally get their phone calls returned by officials they put in office, quote, "I don't think it's going to drive policy." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Really? Golly, little Nelly Sunshine, then why do you think the moneyed interests would bother calling? Just to chat with a corruptible politico or to collect on their investment?" Even Keating must know that these donors are not buying a phone call. They're buying public policy. Really?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Although the United States Department of Education began funding charter schools more than 20 years ago, a new report by the Center for Media and Democracy reveals that the agency failed to track how much has been spent on them. The center's executive director spoke to KABU reporter Robin Ryan about what was learned over the course of the year-long investigation to produce Charter School Black Hole.
I'm talking with Lisa Graves. She is the executive director at the Center for Media and Democracy, and we're going to talk about a report that you published yesterday about charter schools. Can you tell me why you called it the black hole?
It's about how little we, the American people, know about how money is being spent on charter schools. And so we focused in on federal tax monies that are going to states that are then going to charter schools across the country, and how difficult it was to find even a list of the schools that received our tax dollars, and how difficult it was to find out how some of that money was spent.
Your report, if I understood it correctly, identified two primary revenue sources of public funds that flow into charter schools. And though you've been able to generate a number of what's been spent federally, there are indications that figure has been more challenging to develop in terms of the state resources. When do you think that portion of expenditures will see the light of day, and what has to transpire to see it through?
Our hope is that as more and more people understand how much money has gone into charter schools, both federal and state monies, and some of the problems that have arisen, including fraud, but also just money that's gone to schools that never opened or that closed shortly after they opened, that people will insist that they have to follow the regular rules that traditional public schools had to follow in terms of accounting and fiscal responsibility and procurement, so that money isn't wasted.
How readily was the information required to generate this report provided? Was there any difference between the responses from the federal level to the state level?
It was more difficult than we anticipated. The federal government actually had not previously posted a list of the ultimate grant recipients under what's called the CSP-SEA grant, and so they didn't have a list of which schools had received the money. Some states had the list, but they didn't list it out as unnecessarily being federal grant recipients versus recipients of state monies as well. And beyond that, one of the things that happened in our work here was to try to get a list of even the identities of the states that were applying for the new round of funding so that citizens in those states could know and could weigh in. And the Department of Education denied that request as well, refused to provide us and the public with a list of the applicants before the grants were awarded. And as a result, I think a lack of getting information from the public, the Department of Education recently approved an award to Ohio for more funding for charter schools, even though just this summer, the head of its charter school operations within the state had to resign for basically manipulating test results. So I think that if the public were more involved, had more of an opportunity to weigh in, that perhaps something like that would not occur. But also, I think that at the state and local level, people have a right to know where their tax dollars are being spent, and there should be much better posting of information about how much money a particular charter has received and how that money has been spent in real time, and ideally in one place where people can go and find that easily.
In your report, you guys had said that you were quite surprised to learn that folks within the Department of Education at the federal level appeared to have no idea how much had been spent. You tallied that up. It was $3.7 billion.
That's right. We were surprised that no one even could answer how much money had gone into charter schools since they were first funded in the early 1990s. And so we went through a lot of appropriations documents from Congress to try to calculate all the different programs that had fueled charters, and we discovered that the number is over $3.7 billion. That's just at the federal level.
And how does one qualify to be someone who awards, someone who procures? What mechanisms were put in place to assess the quality of these academic environments?
Well, it varies by state, and actually that's another issue that, you know, we think is significant, which is that in a number of states, they have allowed many entities to become what are called authorizers. And in some of those states, the authorizers are purely private, meaning not public, not subject to open records requests or Freedom of Information Act requests. They're purely private entities. They may be nonprofits, but they're still private. And in those instances, what we've seen through audits and other information is that states in some instances have claimed that they don't have any authority to get information from these schools, that the schools are not accountable to them, that they don't report to them, that they only receive money, but that the authorizer is the one that is supposed to be monitoring them. Well, the authorizers are charter school advocates. They're defenders of charter schools. In fact, some of these authorizers are advocating for fewer restrictions, fewer rules and regulations to be applied. And so you have a situation in which federal money is being spent by entities that really aren't responsible or accountable to the people, and in many instances can't find out what's happening at the schools in terms of their spending the same way you can at a local school board, because they're not accountable to the local school board. However, in some states, there are local school boards involved in some of these charter schools.
Talk about the role the American Legislative Exchange Council has played in the promotion of this educational model.
ALEC is an organization that was created in the early 1970s, and it's a group that early on was sort of hostile to traditional public education, including a lot of the debates that were going on nationally in the 1970s about education. And so it was frequently promoting what they dubbed as school choice. And Milton Friedman, who was an economist who, before he passed away, was actively trying to basically kill public schools. He's someone who said there shouldn't be public schools, there should just be free market schools. He had the position like that since basically the year after Brown v. Board of Education. So ALEC has a long history of advocating a variety of measures that have the effect of ultimately undermining public education, in part because their underlying philosophy, and certainly the philosophy that they've presented at numerous ALEC meetings, is one that's hostile to the idea of having public schools and suggests that there should just be whatever the market will allow.
I've been talking with Lisa Graves from the Center for Media and Democracy. For more information, you can visit their website at prwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
the number of adults in the U.S. who admit to using marijuana in the previous year has increased in the past decade. A new study published in the Journal of American Medical Association Psychiatry found that in 2002, about 4.1% of the U.S. adults admitted to having used marijuana in the past year, growing to 9.5% in 2013. The estimated prevalence of marijuana use disorder or marijuana dependence rose from 1.5% in 2002 to 2.9% in 2013. A recent Gallup poll found that currently 58% of the adults in the U.S. favor marijuana legalization. Support for legalization stood at only 34% back in 2002.
Authorities at the United States and Mexico border have discovered yet another drug smuggling tunnel in the San Diego area west of the Otay Mesa port of entry. This one is estimated to have been more than half a mile in length, with electric lights inside, ventilation, and a rail system. Such operations are known as super tunnels. Nine other similar tunnels have been found in the San Diego area in the past decade. Mexican authorities arrested 16 people in connection with the tunnel and seized 320,000 ounces of marijuana.
One of the biggest obstacles faced by the new legal marijuana industry is a lack of banking services. The state of Colorado tried to remedy this last year by chartering a marijuana bank, the Fourth Corner Credit Union. The credit union applied to the Federal Reserve for a master account in November of last year. They were informed in July that the Fed had not approved them for an account, so they filed suit in the U.S. District Court in Denver to force federal approval. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve filed a motion with the court asking that the suit be dismissed, asserting that providing banking services to marijuana businesses should be criminal, or would be criminal. The Department of Treasury issued a memo to banks and regulators containing guidelines for accepting cash from marijuana-related businesses, yet such cash is still regarded as the proceeds of criminal activity under federal law. Colorado's marijuana industry is currently estimated to generate $700 million a year. The final phase of negotiations for a global strategy to combat climate change is off to a rocky start, with developing nations accusing the richest nations, and the United States in particular, of hijacking the process. Nearly 200 nations are meeting in Germany this week for the home stretch of the talks before world leaders meet next month in Paris. FSRN's Jacob Resnick explains.
Delegates are in the city of Bonn to finalize a pact for world leaders to sign next month in France. But on the first day of meetings, developing countries in the so-called G77, which includes China, are balking at the draft put together following the last round in Geneva. The root of their anger is a 20-page document that had been slimmed down from the original 90 pages of proposals each country had worked on earlier this year. The 20 pages now in front of the delegations was prepared by the co-chairs from Algeria and the United States, and the developing world is in open revolt. Speaking for the G77, South Africa's Nosipho Mexicado Diseko said the distributed draft was unacceptable.
It is extremely unbalanced and lopsided, to the extent that it jeopardizes the interests and positions of developing countries. We therefore concluded that the mandate given to the co-chairs was not fulfilled.
Daniel Reifsnyder, a senior U.S. State Department official who worked with his Algerian counterpart to prepare the latest draft, admitted there was more work to do.
Our sense from our pre-sessional consultations is that parties generally like the brevity, clarity, and structure of the text. But your happiness generally stops there.
Delegates will now be meeting behind closed doors to try and keep the deal from collapsing before world leaders even meet. Civil society groups have accused the developed world of trying to fix the game to their advantage and push all the burden on poorer nations. Here's Mina Rahman, a campaigner from the Third World Network.
This is a process which is doomed to not just that it just condemns the planet, it really condemns the poor.
So what is so bad about the text? civic groups say the 20-page draft would rewrite the rules, allowing developed countries to backslide on previous commitments that had set hard emission targets and brought transparency towards emissions. Also dropped from the text was wording on $100 billion in financing from richer nations beginning in 2020 that would help poorer countries shift to less polluting forms of energy production and adapt to unavoidable consequences of global warming, such as rising sea levels. Climate justice advocates say the language is loose and lacks enforcement. It would lead to more talk and less action. Here's ActionAid's senior analyst Brandon Wu's take on it.
There's not ambitious language around what is actually the ultimate goal of this thing. There's no mention of renewable energy anywhere. If you search the whole thing, energy, I think, doesn't show up anywhere. And there was bracketed language around, okay, we can have a long-term goal of maybe near zero emissions by 2050. We think that would be an important step, but obviously governments don't have a whole lot of credibility in talking about a 2050 goal. We need the kind of intermediate short-term steps leading up to that goal. Otherwise, they're basically just kicking the can down the road.
The goal that the countries are supposed to be working towards is to limit the average global warming to just 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit over pre-industrial revolution levels. That's because beyond that, the scientific consensus is that the results would be disastrous. Few expect that even a binding agreement at Paris will save the planet completely. Wu says much more will be needed at the national level, and international agreements like these keep climate change in the conversation. Negotiators now have until Friday to figure out how to achieve that. Then it will be up to world leaders next month to endorse the deal and sign on the dotted line. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Bonn, Germany.
On Wednesday, WikiLeaks began releasing documents from CIA Director John Brennan's non-governmental email accounts, which he is said to have used occasionally for several intelligence-related projects. An individual claiming to be a teenager alleged that he and two other people had hacked into Brennan's AOL account and uncovered files dealing with the CIA director's security clearance application. The hacker told the New York Post that he had used a tactic called social engineering that involves tricking Verizon workers into providing them with personal information and getting AOL to reset the password. The FBI and Secret Service are supposedly investigating this breach. The unredacted documents published Wednesday are Brennan's National Security Position form, which WikiLeaks says reveals a close connection between Brennan and the current director of the CIA. Other documents cover topics like challenges for the United States intelligence community in the post-9/11 world and forbidden torture techniques. Brennan, who defended the CIA in the wake of the Senate torture report, has been accused of willfully providing inaccurate information and misrepresenting the effectiveness of torture.
President Obama today used his for the fifth time in his presidency when he rejected the National Defense Authorization Act. The $612 billion spending bill contained provisions that would have allowed military programs to get around mandatory budget restrictions. It would also have made it more difficult to shut down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. The bill now returns to Congress. Two-thirds majorities in both houses are required to override the president's veto. The House considers the measure first, and a vote is scheduled in that chamber for November 5th.
And President Obama today met with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif at the White House. The meeting comes on the heels of last week's announcement that the United States will keep 5,500 troops stationed in Afghanistan indefinitely, flouting an earlier date for withdrawal. Obama explicitly stated that the troops will remain until a lasting settlement is reached between the Afghan government and Taliban insurgents. Many observers took the statement as a direct challenge to the leadership of Pakistan, whose shadowy intelligence services are strongly linked to the Taliban, which has repeatedly used the Pakistani tribal areas as a jumping-off point for cross-border attacks into Afghanistan. While Obama and Sharif delivered joint public remarks at the White House, the actual topics of discussion centered on economic and sensitive counterterrorism and security issues, including Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban, the potential sale of F-16 fighter jets, and Pakistan's nuclear program. Despite the improved relations implied by the face-to-face talks, it remains to be seen whether Sharif has the power to change the behavior of Pakistan's intelligence services.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Fritcher, Doug McVeigh, Sharika Mitha, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Liam Delta. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO Radio at 7 a.m., it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, guest host Lisa Loving speaks with housing activist Vahid Brown about his grassroots coverage of the City of Portland's sweeps of homeless camps and what is happening next. At 9 a.m. on One Land Many Voices with Mohamed Nabil and Maxine Fuchsen. At 10, tune in to Chris Andre. She'll host Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news ready with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 a.m. on the Radio Zine, host Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher speaks with Norman Cornett, an educator who developed a new way of teaching, which he calls dialogic. It's the subject of a documentary, which is called Professor Norman Cornett, Since When Do We Divorce the Right Answer from the Honest Answer? And at 11:30, TUC Radio will present Professor Alfred McCoy speaking on Obama's geopolitical strategy for containing China. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth with a look at the ongoing violence in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. We'll be right back.